We finished the book of Proverbs, and in going through that, it was a lot of them written by Solomon, but some of them were just collected by him. The general belief at the beginning of his life and his reign as king, things were glorious. It was a glorious kingdom that he inherited from his father David. David had done all the fighting, all the bloodshed. He was a man of war. From when he was very young, he became a man of war, taking on Goliath and following through. And there was innocent blood on the hands of David as well. And David had a desire to build the temple. And he had gone to the Lord and asked, but God told him, no, that's for another. You, David, are a man of blood and a warfare. And it's interesting, when God told David no, he didn't tell him why. It was years later when God explained why he told him no. But David graciously accepted the no from God. Hard for us, isn't it, when God says no to a cherished dream? And this is something, you know, David, even when God said no, he drew up all the plans and bought all the building materials. I can't build it, but, you know, my son will. So, you know, David went as far as he could, short of actually building the temple. What a wonderful man David was. You know, a lot of people, if they have a cherished ministry in their heart that they desire for, and God says no and gives it to somebody else, they'll go pout. David would just get excited for them and do everything he could to empower them to accomplish what was their desire. You know, I know there's a lot of people, when they were young Christians, wanted to be a missionary, wound up being a mom. Wanted to have some exotic country in their sights, that's where I want to go, and they wind up in a career. And a lot of people, they don't continue to have that heart's desire to serve God. They don't get behind somebody else who can go. They just kind of drop it and let their dreams die. And, you know, David, God said no, but his cherished desire to see the temple built didn't die when God said no. And when we have the desire to serve God, even if it's just, you know, to hand off to somebody else so they can score, but just seeing it done, you know, a true love of the work of God is that way. David, a man who came into power, conquered all, you know, in all the years throughout the entire time of Judges, from the time Joshua entered the land, Jerusalem was never conquered. Jerusalem, a capital for thousands of years for Israel now. And it's interesting because after Saul died, there was a civil war between David and those who were supporting the family of Saul. And there was a coronation of David when he first came back into the land after he had been out with the Philistines and not where he belonged. But when he came back into the land, they had a coronation for David that they crowned him as king in Judah. But the rest of Israel refused and rebelled. And David never once asked for, nor forced, nor coerced anybody into doing this. But when there was a second coronation of David, then Jerusalem fell immediately. And isn't it interesting how many of us, we have something like that in our hearts, don't we? That with the Lord, if we would only crown him as the true king. And a lot of us have crowned him as king of a region. You know, we've given him Judah, maybe. You know, he's Lord of this. But it's when we make him Lord of all that we suddenly see long-standing strongholds fall. And David, upon taking Jerusalem, went on from there and extended the influence of his kingdom further than any king before or after him. When Solomon came to power, what was handed to him was the full glory of the kingdom. God had made a promise to Abraham and had set boundaries to it. With David crowned as king, they had exerted their influence. They hadn't populated it. Israel was still a small people comparatively. But militarily, David had conquered everything God had promised them. They were drawing tribute from every piece of land that God said was theirs. And it's a big area that God gave to Israel, not just that little strip that's on the map today. David had to fight. He was a shepherd. He had nothing. He didn't even have encouragement of his father and his mother. David wrote in the Psalms, if my father and my mother reject me, the Lord will take me in. And we see the evidence that David was not highly esteemed with his family. When Samuel had come out to anoint one of the sons of Jesse, Jesse brought all his sons in and they all passed before Saul or Samuel, and Samuel looked at each one and the Lord rejected each one. And after they all went by, he looked at Jesse and said, well, is this it? This can't be it, because God said it's one of your sons, but it's none of those. Don't you have another son? Well, there's David. Can't possibly want David. Well, bring him up. Comes a scrawny little redheaded kid. You know, you can picture him sunburned from being out in the sheep for years and, you know, ruddy complexion, it said. Comes wandering up. And the Lord said, that's my man. That's him. Anoint him. He just poured the oil on him and left. From that moment, David went through many struggles, heartbreaks, failures. David had a life that was so extreme. And he handed it all to Solomon, his son. You know, so often, whether it's a movement of God or what a man may accomplish in his life, when things are just handed to the next generation, it gets lost very rapidly, doesn't it? It's not appreciated. They don't understand the work that went into it. The next generation in a movement of God, they don't know what we went through in the early days of Calvary Chapel. They don't know the struggles and the hardship. People come along, grow up in a church, and go on into the ministry, and so often they lose sight. And David was the one. He handed to Solomon everything. Now, Solomon was, I believe, the fifth child of Bathsheba, the first child having died shortly after its birth because of David's sin with Bathsheba, that first child being conceived in adultery and murder and lying, all that David had done, and so that child died. And now Bathsheba, though, how God works is amazing, isn't it? I mean, a terrible failure, and yet God turns around and raises up Solomon. And with all of his failures, he was still the most glorious king of Israel, because David, right to near the end of his life, had to still fight for the throne. His own son tried to overthrow him. And Solomon, in the meantime, from all the things I could read up on him, was growing up in the harem with his mom, surrounded with moms. You know, you can just picture him. He was a very peaceful man, never went to war. It was just all given to him. He came into an inheritance. And what brilliance he showed in the beginning. When God offered him anything that he wanted, he asked for wisdom. And God gave him wisdom. So here is a guy starting with everything, such potential and promise. You know, he could have just brought such glory to God by his whole life. But Solomon instead went against everything God told the kings of Israel not to do. He did. Don't multiply silver and gold. Don't multiply horses. Don't multiply wives. It's almost like Solomon read that list, went out, okay, I'm going to go get silver and gold. I'm going to buy horses and, you know, 700 wives and 300 concubines. You know, take him almost 3 years just to visit each one. You know, it's ridiculous. Married, a lot of them were political marriages, but God said, don't do that. Solomon, with such great wisdom, people would come from all over the world bringing great gifts to him just to sit before him and hear him speak. You can go back and read the whole story of Solomon. He just demonstrated when God gave him wisdom, people were astonished. Concepts of justice, of rightness, that were just brought into focus by Solomon where none before had been able to expound those things so clearly. The very Proverbs he put together, when you read them in one sentence, it says more than some people can get out in their whole lifetime of worth. You know, it has such understanding and depth, and people would come, queens, kings from all over the world, as he was famous and all that glory. But then he became self-indulgent, started seeking out all the wrong things, fell into idolatry, allowed pagan temples and idols to be set up all over the land because of these many wives that he had, because of the strange women that he had brought in. When Solomon stepped down and died, moved off the scene, what he left behind was a divided kingdom. Israel caved into itself, went into civil war immediately. Some have said, well, it was the wisdom of Solomon that held it together so long. I think it was the folly of Solomon that brought it to the very edge of ruin. And the moment he was off the scene, the kingdom divided. They lost all their influence. It collapsed. And not from that day till now has Israel regained the position it once held with David. It was a downhill run from there. Solomon, because of his foolishness with such wisdom. Isn't it interesting that as you read the Bible, it would seem the great men of God that he raises up, there is such contradiction in most of them. There's very few like Daniel of which there is no contradiction presented to us. God's very honest and shows us the whole picture. Daniel's one of the only guys in the Bible that we see no failings, no sins. Just, he was a wonderful man. Oh, down in Babylon, everything against him. But Solomon, God is brutally honest. He multiplied wives, multiplied horses, multiplied gold. Heart departed from the Lord. He fell into idolatry. So from Proverbs, in the beginning of his kingdom and its great glory, to Ecclesiastes, he had lived out a lifetime. And many speculate this book of Ecclesiastes was written right after he had repented from his idolatry and from many, many years that he wasted on all these things. And these are the conclusions he came through from going out and doing things his own way. A few things about this book. It is agreed upon by the Jews that this work is the fruit of his repentance and reflecting on what he did. And what this book basically proposes to us is that no labor that we do in this world will make us content. That no possessions that we gain in this world will make us from content. And in fact, this book concludes that earthly possessions are an obstacle to contentment. That when we have everything, they actually get in the way of our peace of mind. And a third thing in this book that we must say as a conclusion or a proposition is generally the world has no idea that these things are true. They are pursuing all these things that are vain and empty, and they haven't got a clue that they will never be satisfied. It begins in verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man of all his labor which he takes under the sun? Meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. What profit is there? I want you to notice a phrase here, under the sun. Remember that in this book. Most of what this book is about is what's under the sun. And if you can only think of what's under the sun, your life will be limited. World War II, there was this one area that they had to shoot grappling hooks up on a cliff and climb ropes to get up and take out a particular position where there was a gun that the Germans had up there. And when these men landed, it was very high risk, because if you can manage climbing a cliff while people are on top trying to shoot you, and these grappling hooks would be fired up there. Now, if that grappling hook didn't make it over the top of the cliff, if it went up and hung up on something 20 feet short of the top, how far are you going to be able to climb? 20 feet short of the top, right? You can't go any further than what you said. You see, I talk to people often in marriage that they look at their marriage and go, well, what do you want in your marriage? They go, well, to be content, to be happy together, you know, just to have a good family, to do all this. You see, their rope isn't even halfway up the cliff. You know why God wants you to be married? To glorify him. See, that throws it up into eternity, doesn't it? That gives us a rope that we'll never run out of climbing. That'll give us a motivation to keep on, even when these lesser goals fail for a season. Oh, I want content. I want a good family. Well, what about when you're fighting? and you're not having it. People just walk away. And a lot of it is because they haven't set their sights high enough. But everything that we're going to read about here is under the sun. And I would say this, that when we're under the S-O-N, when we're under the sun, everything's different, isn't it? But under the sun, as all mankind lives, he comes to this conclusion. I want you to notice the book of Proverbs, he just simply states, Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. And I think his lack of influence in the world is already showing here. Here he says, king in Jerusalem. It would seem that things have become somewhat lessened, that he no longer views himself the same way he did earlier in his life when he wrote the Proverbs. And so this meaningless, all the things that we run into, think about it. I've watched people waste their whole lives for shiny trinkets. You know, have you ever seen a bird trying to get a raven going after a shiny trinket? You know, ooh, a shiny. You know, they want it. And there's nothing to it. They can't eat it. They can't do anything with it. It's just an attraction to them. And I've watched people. I once had a neighbor that he didn't have much money. He had a beat-up old car, but he'd buy something new for his car, and it'd keep him happy for 6 months. I was amazed it contented him for so long. I mean, one time he bought a Ooga horn on the thing. I got sick of hearing it. He loved that horn, man. You know, he just, I got an Ooga horn. You know, after that, he bought a little portable stereo, and he was just delighted with that for the longest time, carrying it around, sitting in the yard, playing weird music, and, you know, this guy was in his 70s. And he was just still captivated with trinkets. When you brought up the Lord to him, the blank wall. You know, it was just no interest in eternity. How sad it is that the world has not realized that it's all meaningless. Apart from God, this life is absolutely meaningless. Anything we can do. He just begins the book with this outright statement that what profit has a man from all his labors? What good is it? Goes on in verse 4. One generation passes away and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. The sun also rises. The sun goes down and hastens to his place where he arose. The wind goes towards the south and turns around to the north. It whirls about continually and then returns again according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea isn't full, onto the place from where the rivers come, and there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. He just looks at the repetition of things. You know, I wonder how many of you have to watch the weather once a day on TV. You know, I have to see the weather report. I don't know why. Not like you can do anything about it. You know, but if I can't catch it, you know, the local weather, I go on the internet and look it up. You know, and it's always wrong anyhow. But you know, it's like, okay, which way is the wind blowing tomorrow? Who cares? You know, if you get up, step outside, it's too cold, I'll get a jacket on. It's hot, I'll put a T-shirt on. You know, I mean, you don't really, and yet, you know, it's like we have such a fascination. To Solomon, he's going, the sun comes up, it goes down, it comes up, it goes down. The wind blows this way and that way and this way and that way. Goes in circles and it comes back and, you know, you live long enough, you're okay, another Santa Ana day. It's going to be dry, my sinuses are going to hurt. Another one of these days, you know, now it's damp and cold and foggy. Now it's this, now it's that. But it's an endless, it just goes on. And yet people will try to claim, well, weather's changing. Different these days, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, I've only been around 50 years, and it just pretty much seems like summer comes, and then fall, and then winter, and then spring, and then summer. It just keeps going. In the winter, I want to hibernate. You know, you just get tired, and bed feels better. You know, in the spring, you want to clean. I mean, I think that spring cleaning thing's true. All of a sudden, you know, I'm going to clean the garage. You just get in this mood. You know, you want to go do things. All of a sudden, wow, this is exciting. You know, in summer, you survive. You get through the heat out here. You know, in the fall, it's like I always get a little depressed. It reminds me when I had to go back to school. You know, I don't like the fall because, you know, it was like, you know, that season always meant back at school. And you know, summer's over. The fun has ended. And then winter again. Back sleepy. Goes on and on. It doesn't change. You know, water goes into the ocean, evaporates, goes over land, it makes a river, goes back to the ocean, it just keeps going. He's just talking about the endless cycle of things. You know, for man, one generation comes up, another goes, you know, and when they die, there's another one coming. When they die, there's another one coming. It's just, he's looking at life from this perspective of under the sun. What's the point of all of it? Why do it? Everything is full of labor. It's hard. Life is hard, isn't it? It's filled with hardship. We live thinking these moments of happiness, grabbing for them, but admit it, they're pretty rare. We have more trouble. In fact, the average American family has been reduced to a problem-solving unit. It's about all they do together is solve problems. They've forgotten how to have fun and enjoy things. How to step back a little bit, but it's so full of labor. You know, it says man can't utter it. The eye isn't satisfied with seeing, the ear isn't filled with hearing. Isn't that the truth? I mean, I've been blessed by God to get to go to some places. I've seen some incredible things. And I've been in the middle of the Yucatan down in Mexico. I carried Debbie piggyback one time for almost a mile because she wanted to see a pyramid. And she still was walking a little at that time, but she got a little bit out in the jungle and the heat and everything got to her. I really want to see it. So, you know, I picked her up and carried her piggyback, probably a mile, a little bit more than that. And just as we're getting up where all the people are at the pyramid, she's going, "You can put me down?" And I go, "No way. Nobody's seen me doing this yet." You know? I've suffered for the last mile. You know, somebody's going to know I did this, you know? And I carried her on up there and put her down. And, you know, we walked around, looked at the pyramid. And she hands me the camera and goes, "Honey, I really want a picture from the top." Okay, you know, climb up to the top, take pictures. Nothing to see up there. You climb up. They hadn't even cleared the jungle away from this pyramid yet. They were just, you know, just working. I mean, the jungle. So I took a picture of endless flat canopy of trees and then climbed back down and gave her a camera back. And then I'm thinking, it's about a mile and a half, 2 miles back. And I looked around. There was this Guatemalan guy there with one of these three-wheel bicycles where they carry stuff up front, you know, where the two tires are in the front and they load them up. And I said, "How much you charge me to take my wife back down the hill?" So I gave the guy $5 and set Debbie in the front of that thing. She got kind of beat up, but, you know, a rough ride back, you know. Pretty bumpy road with no shocks and, you know, laying, sitting on a metal platform, but got her down. I saw that. I've seen Hawaii. What incredible beauty. I've been snorkeling in places. I've been underwater with incredible beauty around me and seen things. I've seen beauty. I've seen the jungles in the Philippines. I stood on the very beach where the Battle of Leyte would have been waging right out there in front of me where MacArthur landed in Leyte and saw the exotic beauty of those jungles and you know, the bugs and the all that stuff. I've seen Hong Kong. You want to talk about an eyeful? I mean, it's a bizarre city. First of all, they drive on the wrong side of the street. You know, huge buses. I mean, every time I went across the street, somebody grabbed, I don't know how many times that my life was saved there because I was looking the wrong way, expecting the cars to be coming, you know, just stepping out, whoosh, you know, this big old bus goes by. Incredible sights. I've seen southern China, Kunming and Peking and I've seen the Alps and what green and beauty. But you know what? Now that I'm home, it doesn't mean anything more to me than if I watched a travel log on television. The fact, while I was there, I felt like I couldn't connect with it. I was like, this is so beautiful. I wish my eyes are never satisfied. You'll never see something and go, that's it. They've served their purpose. I'm happy now. Your ears are never satisfied. You'll never hit a day when you go, I've heard enough. Always some new tidbit of knowledge, some new music, some new bird to listen to. You know, as my hearing is fading, I lost crickets about 2 years ago. And it's not bad entirely because we have these little kind of white-colored crickets that are a real nuisance and they keep Debbie awake. I just snore right through them, you know. They don't bother me. But I do miss crickets. Are my ears satisfied? Have I heard? No, don't you see that we desire these things so deeply, and yet when we have them, they're not enough. It's never enough. It never satisfies, no matter how far we go, no matter what we've seen. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate what God has let me see, but I just want to see more. I want to go someplace else and look at something else. Once I saw the Alps, and they are incredible. No movie can give you a panorama. The greens in Europe are greener than ours. I mean, the beauty there is indescribable. If you've never seen it, you just can't imagine. And yet, so what? My eyes aren't satisfied. I didn't come back. In fact, you know, I don't even look at the pictures of it that much. You know, I look once and I go, okay, yeah, it was really beautiful. Okay. What's next? There's got to be something else to look at. Now in verse 9, he says, the thing that has been is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It has been already of old time, which was before. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. More of the pointlessness and vanity of life. There is no new thing. You see, it's hard to convince people that there's nothing really new under the sun. You know, Debbie and I bought quite a few things through the catalog, since Debbie can rarely get to the malls anymore. She discovered she can just type things in her computer and they show up at the door. So, you know, it didn't stop her from shopping. But they get your name. And I got a magazine the other day called Gadget Universe. That's my kind of thing. And they have a website. And you can just go in there for hours and go, ooh, you know, look at that. And then in the end, it's just a flashlight. They had torches in the old days. There's really nothing essentially new under the sun. Look at man. Is he gotten better? I mean, I've read some pretty in-depth things, history. When I read history, I want to get into the people's lives and see what they were like. And you can go back 2,000 years or 4,000 years. They had marriage problems. It was no different than it is today. True, most of them were living a lifestyle of farmers, and they weren't rushed. They didn't have the pressures we have. You know, just think of all the wonderful time-saving gadgets that we spend 80 hours a week working for. You know, they don't save you any time. Oh, I got to have a microwave. I got to have this, you know. But is it really a new thing? You get hot food, you can get that from a campfire. It's essentially not new. It does it faster. I mean, there really is nothing where you can go, now this has never been before. Here is something that has never existed, and now it exists. You know, Solomon says, show me something. Is there anything that you can name that way? Then he goes on to say that everything that has been done that we do has been done before, and we don't remember the people that did it before. And guess what? 100 years from now, nobody's going to be thinking about us. John who? Lake Elsinore? Where's that? And who cares? What pointlessness to life if it's not attached to eternity. How meaningless it is. And he's driving that home. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I gave my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all things that are done under the sun, under heaven. This sore travail God has given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Things that are crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate. I have gotten more wisdom than all that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this is also vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and in increased knowledge is increased sorrow. Okay. All the gadgets, all the things, you know, you give yourself over, all the things the eye can look at, all the things the ear can hear. That doesn't satisfy. So he said, knowledge. Maybe knowledge will be it. Can you just picture Solomon? He's hit this point in his life where his heart's drifted from God, and he's just looking around the world. He's got all the money that he could get anything he wants. And one of his first quests was knowledge and wisdom. This guy probably had knowledge equivalent to holding several doctorates. He pursued every form of knowledge. There's written records that of him studying all the plants and animals, all the flora and fauna that he could find on this planet, to study them, to understand them. Every other area of science and knowledge, he pursued it all. Have you ever run into somebody addicted to education? You know, they start off, well, I'm, you know, first I'm going to get this degree. And then, you know, right before they graduate, well, you know what, I need to go 2 more years. And they keep thinking, more knowledge, knowledge. You know, people will tell you, education, that's it, that's the ticket. Well, you know, you need to be educated to survive in this world. But it won't satisfy you any more than anything else will. In fact, just like he said, increased wisdom just increases your sorrow, your heartbreak. It's just, it's a grief. The more you understand, as you look at the world around you, as you see what people do, your heart breaks. As you expand your horizons, as you start reading more and more, and you become aware of all that's in this world, and you gain knowledge, if you're looking for it to satisfy you, it won't. It just leaves you emptier. What do you do with it? Can't eat it. In the end, when you gain it all, you see, because here's what's happening. You know, you hit a point in your life where suddenly you realize, you know, I want to know these things. I started reading all that I could lay my hands on years ago before I went in the ministry. I just got this hunger for things. And reading was hard for me, but then reading became easier and easier, and I just started eating up books and eating all these things and just wanting to know about history and this and that and reading books on World War II. Whatever, you know, caught my fancy, I would just grab books on it and start digging into it. And I have, you know, a patchwork of knowledge. It's not complete. There's no continuity to it because I'll get interested in something and run it to death and then take off on another trail, find some rabbit trail and go down that. And in all the knowledge, as you start knowing more and looking around the world, the heartbreak of mankind just grows with you. You come to understand that, you know, it is vexation. It's difficulty. And with all that knowledge, you can't fix one person's life. You can't make one person change their ways. That which is crooked can't be made straight, no matter how much you know. You see, the Army Corps of Engineers decided that they knew how to take something crooked and make it straight, and they fixed the Mississippi River. And we've been having people's homes and houses and cities wiped out ever since because the Mississippi is going to go where it wants to. You may control it for a while, but it's just going to pick its own course. And it's changed courses on people a few times. I mean, it's, you know, you can't... In the end, what can you really do with all that knowledge except that you got a greater understanding of what's wrong, but no method to change it? So often I've met with people, and I know that the knowledge that I gave them, if they would have followed what the Word of God said, that their lives would have changed. But in the end, they do what they want. In the end, I do what I want, regardless of what I know. You know, and he just says, the pursuit of education won't satisfy you. Wisdom and knowledge only increase your problems, and nothing really changes with that. Chapter 2, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's madness. Of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched my heart. How to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my great works. I built myself houses. I planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants. I had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of the king and all the of all the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked at all the works that my hands had done on the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. Was no profit under the sun. Think of all the things he just listed there. I gave myself over to indulge myself completely. And notice when he mentioned that I'll drink the wine that I want, he said I kept wisdom with me. He didn't become a drunkard. But he had all the fine things in life. This was a man who, like somebody who has good control over alcohol, which very few Americans do, but they eat in the best restaurants, you know, $500 dinners, whatever, best wine, the best of everything. This wasn't that he gave himself over to a drunken party when he says, I decided to deny myself nothing. I went ahead and had all the best of things. It's weird what's popular in different seasons. You know, today we might say, well, you know what, I'm just going to indulge. I'm going to go down to this such and such a restaurant and get Australian lobster tail, and you know, I'm just going to eat the mud pie even though I'm so full afterward. I'm going to have it all tonight, and we'll just decide to indulge ourselves sometimes. And it's expensive. Feels really good until the MasterCard bill comes in, you know. He said, I'm just going to go indulge myself and have the best of the best. And to indulge yourself like that, he said, and he lived that way. Now, this was a man who had the money to do it. You know, we might say lobster tail. You know, there was a craze in the whole Roman Empire for a while for flamingo tongues. Yeah, pickled, fried, all different ways. But, I mean, you know, people were crazy about flamingo tongues. They drove them to the edge of extinction. They almost wiped them off the planet until it stopped. I mean, they were just crazy about, you know, so he had flamingo tongues, you name it. You know, it was there on the plate. It was served to him. He didn't deny himself any pleasure. He said, I'm going to test myself with mirth, you know, with joyfulness, with giving myself over to just enjoy. I look at the world around, look at these people. They're enjoying themselves. I'm going to enjoy myself like that. And he poured himself into it, just like he did into knowledge. And from there, he went on and said, I'm going to build houses. You know, that's indulging yourself, isn't it? Imagine if you had the money where you say, you know what? I'm not going to build a house. I'm going to build the most wonderful dream house that anybody, you know, the absolute everything I wanted, the biggest fireplace, the best swimming pool, you know, all the landscaping, everything I can think of. And you know what? I'm not going to just build one house. I'm going to build a bunch of houses. I'm going to have a summer house and a fall house and a spring house. I'll have servants move all my favorite stuff around for me. I don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to say, hey, I'm heading out to this palace now. I'm going to go over to this house. Solomon did that. How many of us think that a property, a house, you know, that's a big one, isn't it? Draws the picture of contentment, all sitting in front of the fireplace. And there is a certain feeling, and it does last for a little while, doesn't it? But in the end, he looked at all that he did. He said, I planted. I went out and put in orchards. Ah, beautiful. Blooming trees to watch them grow. Put in pools of water for them. You know, built a whole system just so that he could have his own gardens. And when we're talking gardens in that part of the world, I mean, we're talking every flowering plant walking through. You know, if you've ever been someplace, you know, where they've just gone all out on the landscaping, somebody who's wealthy, where they brought in exotic plants and just, you know, to walk through pleasant little places to sit, you know, running water here and just all, you know, to picture just this, it's so ideal. I planted all these things, I had all these gardens, and I looked at it and I just indulged myself in all the fruit. I said, this is the labor of my hand. And then I got done and looked at it, and lo and behold, vanity. I'm still not satisfied. I just want another house. I want a better garden. I want to be somewhere else. The restlessness of the human spirit when it hasn't been touched by God is never satisfied. One of the sadder things for me is seeing somebody poor who daydreams about trinkets all their life. And they could be content with the Lord. Somebody who's rich, very often they've discovered the trinkets don't make them happy. But a person who's never had them keeps wanting them. Solomon had it all. He indulged himself in every way that you can think of. He listed quite a bit here. I gave myself to him. I did great works, built houses. Or then he said, I had servants take care of my every need. That would be nice. You know, get up in the morning and just, hey, pour my coffee for me. You know, just, you know, I mean, you know, just imagine, you know, just having not one servant, but servants just there to wait on you. And then he had music. Went out and got the best singers and all the musicians, you know, hired the latest band to play live music for him anytime he wanted it. It's amazing when you're young. I remember once a guy asking me, he said, well, if I come to Christ, will I have to give up rock and roll? And I looked at him and I said, well, if it's more important to you than Christ, yeah. If it's competing with him, you're going to have to give it up. I didn't have to because it's no big deal to me. You know, what music is to one person, you know, it's different to another. Music is not inherently good or evil. It's just music. There's different styles of it. It can be used to glorify God. It can just be beautiful music. I like all different kinds of music. But again, is the ear ever satisfied with it? You know? Kids get so into their music. They get at that age where it's so influential on them. And it's a powerful thing. Solomon had that. And when he looked at all of it, grasping at the wind, nothing profits. What good does it do? Verse 12, I turn myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do who succeeds a king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, all as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise than of the fool, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. And boy, you know, I've got all this wisdom, and I'm going to die just like the idiots do. I'm smarter than anybody, but my brain cells are going. You know, what happens? You know, I remember reading once, if you exercise something, even brain cells that they found out, you know, and I've been exercising, but it's not working all that good. My ability to retain things is definitely not what it used to be. You know, I got a long ways to go, but you got to remember, I only started down this road with a couple of brain cells left, you know, and I can't afford to lose too many more. You know? I don't know how many are left up there, but they're all working overtime already. You look at it and go, we're all going to die. Look at all this stuff. And then we die. You labor, you sorrow, you go through all this stuff. You're looking for satisfaction and it never comes to you. It's all vanity and vexation. And I put myself into wisdom and I realized wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. But what good does it do you? You die. You go down into the grave. Some people might remember you for a few years, but given enough time, I go over, you know, I'm in cemeteries a lot. A lot of unvisited graves there. Forgotten people. Go stand and read them. You know, I look, there's a date and another date. And that dash is a whole person's life. And all that's left of them is a dash on a rock in a cemetery. You see, under the sun, remember, we're not talking those who have got their grappling hook up in heaven, who have gone over the sun. Those who have tapped into eternity are not those that are under the sun. But recognize this, the pursuits that man goes after, many Christians can get caught up in. We can start thinking, this latest gadget. You see, I used to get Gadget Universe stuff like that. I never saw the Gadget Universe before a couple weeks ago. You know, it's a cool thing. I mean, they got things in there so that if you don't exercise, you can breathe in this. It'll keep your lungs built up, you know. It's just got, you know, every gadget you can think of, you know. I mean, I've got some pages folded over so I can go back and look at them again, you know. You see, I have a problem. I used to convince myself I needed gadgets. You know, I'd look at those, you know, like I got these really trippy little flashlights that last for 100 years, shine a mile away, you know, and just you look at that and go, wow, that's really cool. And I'll start thinking, you know, I can really use that. You know, I remember the last time I was in Germany, they locked me upstairs and turned the lights out, and I couldn't find my way out. And I'm going, I'm not going to Germany anymore. I never leave the house. What do I need this stupid thing? Got 10 flashlights in the house already. You know, so I can't put it in my pocket, you know. And you picture, well, yeah, you know, that really come in handy. When? When was the last time you used a flashlight? I mean, really needed a flashlight in your pocket at that moment, you know. But you know, you'll look at, oh, yeah, I got to have it. You see, some people are just waiting for the new gadget. Doesn't cut it. Christians, beware. No man can serve two masters. We cannot serve anything under the sun and serve the kingdom of God at the same time. Our hearts must be loyal to heaven. Because anyone who tries to serve two masters will hold to the one and despise the other. And if you're trying to have two masters, if you're trying to be happy in this world and please God at the same time, it just won't work. If you try to please God, happiness comes and goes in people's lives, whether they will it or not, with very little control over it. How many good seasons have you had? And look back at them, the best times in your life. Were they well planned and executed, or did it just happen? It was just a good season. And the bad seasons come. But you see, with God, we have something more than the rest do. Wisdom does excel folly. But in the end, we all go to the grave. I've had a couple times in the hospital that I thought were going to be my last time. That's kind of a thought that hit me one day. I hate those little gowns they give you. They're not made for people 6'4". You know, can't do anything. Carry pillows around with you everywhere, you know. You know, whatever, I don't know. I always ask for, you know, you used to be, I'd go in there and I'd say, you know what, I want you to go down to surgery and get me a pair of pants, you know, and I'll dress up like a surgeon. Then you can get out, walk around, people move out of your way and stuff, you know. But, you know, I remember once being in there thinking, oh, man, for most of us, if the Lord tarries, that's how we're going to be dressed when we leave here. You're going to check into one of those places someday and not check out. Have you ever looked at your home and thought, I may never come back here again? This is my last trip. I've been in the hospital where it was bad enough that I thought, this is it. I'm not getting out of here this time. And oh, how sad if you don't have Christ. How peaceful it is if you do have Him. Before I knew the Lord, I used to think, you know, if I found out I was terminal, I'd hike up into the Rockies somewhere and find a beautiful sight, just sit down and die. But now that I've been a pastor for a while, I've watched how much pain there can be and how comforting it can be in a hospital. And I'll tell you something, if I get something terminal, that's where I want to be. I don't care what the scenery is like, just keep me comfortable because I'm heading someplace beautiful. I don't really care where I die. You know, the truth is, though, that absolute reality, we're all going there. I want you to stop and think about it. You know, what if today, you know, you leave here tonight, this is the last time you get to come in this building. What if you die on the way home? It can happen. See, some people have some warning of it. I remember my dad's last trip to the hospital. You know, He's home. He's home. He's in heaven. And one day, we all go there. Every time I do a funeral, I watch up, I picture myself in one of those boxes, and go, I'm heading that way. And they'll close the lid on me and throw me in the ground. There'll be a few people that cry. A few people will rejoice that I'm home with the Lord. And if the Lord tarries, there won't be anybody that even remembers me. But my name's written in heaven. And there's one who will never forget me. And so, set your sight on things above, not on things here on earth. Because you have died and your life is hid with Christ in God. Do you understand those words a little better with the words of Solomon? You're dead. And your true life is hid with Christ in God. Every time I start to get depressed, I just remind myself, this isn't my real life. It's just kind of a bad dream. I'm going to wake up here pretty soon and be in heaven. Well, you know, when God put Adam to sleep in the garden, it doesn't say he ever woke him up. You know? Eve was wide awake, but, you know, Adam, he just, oh, what? You know, we've been that way ever since. I'm going to be home. We're all going to be home someday. But without Christ, oh, how empty and vain this life is. Let's pray. God, we are so thankful that you've given us purpose, reason to live, that your glory can come into every aspect of our life if we choose to allow it, be it our marriage, our homes, the food that we eat, that we can rejoice that all of it is a wonderful gift from you, and all of it can be tied to you, to your glory, to your goodness, to your kingdom. So God, help us to understand what it truly means that the chief aim of man is to glorify his Maker. And let us live our lives that way, because only in that do all these things have meaning. And in that, God, what rich meaning you give everything. So Lord, as we have seen what's under the sun, Lord, I pray our hearts and eyes will be set on what's beyond the sun. In Jesus' name, amen.